Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Richard and Joy Morris. How are you guys?
Fine, thanks.
Fine, thank you, Chris.
Excellent, excellent. Slight Welsh accent on Joy and Richard. We're in Anchor Hill Vineyards in Wales.
You are indeed.
Vineyard without an S.
Vineyard without an S.
No. Vineyard.
Yeah, not vineyards. Yep. Okay. But we were talking earlier that you're hoping to have an S on the end at some point.
Possibly, yeah. We are looking to expand the vineyard, yes.
What we'll do is we'll have a chat, find out a bit about yourselves. It's the first time I've ever been to a Welsh vineyard. I've been to quite a few English ones, but I've never been to a Welsh one. But start off with, some of our listeners are in the US and Argentina and all sorts of crazy places. Let's start with an easy one. Where's Wales?
It's the little bit of the country that sticks out on the west side of England.
So, yeah, it's above Cornwall, isn't it?
Yes, above Cornwall and west of Bristol. So,
and south of Liverpool.
So, and you're basically on the west coast. See, Wales, I always think of Wales as being quite a wet place. Most west coast places are wet, but it's a lovely sunny day today.
Yeah, it is. Large parts of Wales is quite wet because it's quite mountainous and it's got a lot of exposure to southwest prevailing weather, of course, and most of the coastline is southwest facing. But really, if you're planting a vineyard in a place like Wales, it's all about choosing the right site. And we've got a really good little meso climate. Some people call it microclimate here. We're very sheltered. We've got more of a sort of continental style climate than a maritime type climate. So it's an ideal place for planting a vineyard.
Where are we in Wales? You know, we're on the west coast of England, not of England, because Wales isn't part of England. Let's just be very careful about that. It's its own country. Is it its own country in its own right?
Wales is, yeah. Wales has got its own government now, yeah. Which is devolved and it has certain powers, but it's not a totally independent country, so things like taxation, for example, and foreign policy and that sort of thing is decided by Parliament in London.
Okay, and where are we in Wales here?
We're in southeast Wales, so we're right on the border with England. It's almost a little country in its own right, the borders.
Is this called the borders, or is that the area between Scotland and England?
Well, that is the borders. I suppose historically it was called the Welsh Marches.
Okay.
And whoever held power in the Welsh Marches pretty well ran the whole of the country. So.
Oh, really?
I mean, places like Gloucestershire, Herefordshire and Shropshire used to be Welsh if you go back a century or so. So it has evolved. Monmouthshire actually used to be in England up until about 1974, I think, when by an act of Parliament it was, I don't know what the word is, ceded to Wales. So, oh, okay. You know, it's quite a history, actually.
We're right on the border. We're not actually far from Three Choirs, which is probably a more famous English vineyard than possibly you guys, maybe.
Yeah, well, Three Choirs are 20 miles up the road. And historically, to date, they have made our wine. From this year, actually, we will be producing our own wine. And we hope to be building a winery starting later this year.
And there's a like an inlet type thing or a river flow or something like that, that sort of comes down between England and Wales. Is it a river that comes in? It's like a real sharp.
Yeah, there's the Severn Estuary and the River Severn. And for quite a way of the River Severn, it is basically the border between England and Wales. Not everywhere, but it's sort of broadly the border. Our site, Monmouth, is about 30 miles north of the Severn Estuary, roughly, rough numbers.
Okay, so that's a bit far away to get any sort of Atlantic or ocean currents.
Yeah, we tend not to get a strong maritime influence. I mean, to give you an example, Cardiff, which is, what, 40-odd miles to the west of here, the capital of Wales, has about four times the rainfall levels that we do here in the growing season. So it's quite an interesting difference in climate.
How many mils do you get in a typical year?
Well, last year we got...
last year, everybody.
Yeah, last year we were just over 500 mil. It's about 550, I think. But typically we average less than 300 mil in the growing season. Growing season I define as beginning of April through to the end of October. So it's a 7-month period.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And how long you guys been making wine here?
Well, we planted the vineyard in 2006 and 2007 and then had our first vintage in 2008 from the 06 planting. So we're still a relatively young vineyard.
Yeah, yeah. And when you planted, what did you plant up?
Initially, we planted mostly Sauval Blanc with some Triomphe and a little bit of Pinot Noir. Mm-hmm. Because we really wanted to plant Pinot Noir, and everybody said we were mad. So we thought we'd plant some and see how it went. Loved it. So the following year, we planted the whole of the front vineyard, which is all Pinot Noir, and some Chardonnay.
And the house that we're in, quite a big, impressive house, really, isn't it? Well, compared to my little almost postage stamp house in London. Have you guys been here all the time, or did you buy the land for the vineyard, or what was the process?
We bought the house in 1998 and had most of the land with the house. And then we just bought the field at the front in 2006.
Mm-hmm. When we bought the house, I was still running my business, and we were very interested in wine, obviously, but we didn't really envisage planting a vineyard at that stage. And it's after we'd sold the business around about 2002, 2003. We'd traveled a lot and been to vineyards all over the world and really sort of got quite interested in the idea of planting a vineyard. And we very nearly moved to Tasmania. We looked at very seriously. We also looked at Central Otago, New Zealand, from your home place, which you'd be interested to know, and places in the south of France like Roussillon. But I did a viticulture course at Plumpton College, which is part of Brighton University. And one of the things I learned to do was to select a site and know how to select a vineyard site, which is of interest and worked. And I woke up to the fact that we had a really good potential vineyard site here, very sheltered, very good drainage, south-facing, of course, that sort of continental rather than maritime climate that we discussed. And we did soil samples, and then I looked at stats from the Met Office for the last 25 years. And to my surprise, actually, we found that over the last sort of 25 years, Monmouth is right up in the sort of top 5% quartile in terms of being a really good climate in UK terms. I'm talking about sort of, you know, relatively low rainfall levels and relatively high sunshine hours in that important growing season. Okay. So we decided to stay and plant it here.
I suppose the reason I heard about you guys is because you won the Bonaccino del Mondo Award. Is that how you pronounce it?
Bollicini del Mondo, which Bollicini is sparkling of the world, I think it means in Italian.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so you won that, and you won that, Camel Valley had won it a few years.
Yeah, Camel Valley, I think in, now let me get my years right, we won it in 2012. I think Camel Valley won in 2010, 2011 with their sparkling rosé, so mm-hmm. they're two separate competitions. And I know Nye Timber won the sparkling white that we won in 2009.
England and Wales have been doing quite well in that award. Why do you think that is?
That's very interesting because, you know, we are up against sparkling wines from all over the world, including champagnes, of course. You know, I've always said, as Bob Lindo has at Camel Valley, that we're not trying to replicate champagne. We're producing English and Welsh sparkling wine, and it's a different type of sparkling. But I think, you know, the judges probably like the complex nature of our sparkling wines. They like the acidity, of course. There's a really good natural acidity there. And I think also, you know, with the way winemaking in the UK has come on in the last decade, you know, people are lees aging wine longer. They're not looking at to deacidify where they've got the right sort of acidity levels. And I think the winemaking capabilities and equipment has improved as well. Definitely the viticulture management has improved in the UK in the last sort of decade. So I think probably, Chris, it's a combination of all those features.
Okay, so that's quite good. How's the award helped you guys? Obviously, we knew about it, so that's why we're here. But have you had lots of coverage or press coverage from it?
Yes, we've had quite a bit, especially when it was first announced. And it's like any award, people hear about it and then they want to try the wine, and it also it's a good way of selling the wine, because obviously it means it's of a very good quality.
And we tried some of your wines earlier, actually, and they were quite good. I particularly like your Sauvignon Blanc. It's not the one that won the award, but the next vintage, but it's quite a tidy wine, actually. I was quite impressed in your Chardonnay. But a barrel fermented Chardonnay as well. Yeah. Brave man, very brave man on a barrel fermented.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, what winning things like the Bollocchini does is it gives you credibility, because, you know, one of the things that we have been up against really is, you know, the perception, as you said earlier, people say it always rains in Wales, and it's people not understanding that it's all about what sort of mesoclimate you've got and where you're geographically situated. That's important. Mm. And of course, things like, you know, grape varieties like Chardonnay and Pinot Noir are cool climate varieties, and they grow far better in cooler climates. So if you look at Australia, for example, you know, Pinot is grown well in Tasmania and parts of Margaret River where the climate is cooler. So providing you've got the right mesoclimate, with the right sort of sunshine hours and relatively low rainfall, then, you know, Pinot and Chardonnay do grow very, very well in this climate. You don't get the same sugar levels. You're not getting sort of 13.5% natural alcohol, but you are getting 11.5%. So you can make a really nice low alcohol wine, either a red Pinot, of course, sparkling as well.
Okay. Other grape varieties you've got in there are Triomphe, which you've used to make a rosé wine. How do you find that?
Yeah, we haven't got a lot of Triomphe. We've got about nearly an acre, so we don't make a huge amount, but it seems to work very well with the still rosé. It's one of these hybrid grape varieties where the juice, when you press it, is red. It's not clear.
So the flesh is red, a bit like Rondo's.
Yeah, exactly like Rondo. You know, if you're trying to make a delicate still wine, then you really don't want the influence of the skins on that wine, the tannins and phenols coming off that skin. So it's quite a nice way to make a light, easy-drinking rosé.
Okay, and you make a sparkling rosé and...
We make still Chardonnay and a red Pinot, of course.
Yeah. Oh, that's right, the Pinot.
You've got in front of you now.
Just for quality assurance purposes, enjoying it myself. Okay, fantastic. Strangely enough, you won the award with your sparkling Sauvignon Blanc, but I read on your website that you're actually going to be pulling it out, or you've pulled it out.
It's now all gone.
Is that a mistake or what?
No, it's not a mistake. I mean, we are trying to double the size of the vineyard, and we've struggled really to find the right site, and we hope we're getting there now. We've got a couple of sites which we're very interested in, but it was a question really of what grape variety we use to make our still whites. Sauval does make very, very good sparkling wine. It doesn't make such a good still white because the sugar levels tend to be much lower on Sauval than some other varieties. And we've always loved Albarino, as a personal choice of a white wine to drink with food. And David, our son, and I, we did quite a lot of research some 3 to 4 years ago. Went over to Galicia, where they grow a lot of Albarino, and talked to some producers and really sort of researched how they grew it. And we feel that Albarino is going to grow really well in our little miso climate. We have a much lower rainfall level than they have in Galicia. We're much more sheltered because it's obviously quite windy in Galicia. They do have hotter summers, but they tend to ripen the Albarino to about 13% natural alcohol, and they pick sort of mid-September. So we're talking about picking mid-October. We're not trying to get 13% alcohol. 11.5% will be absolutely fine, and we can make a nice, light, different type of Albarino here, and we think it's going to work.
So you've pulled out the Sauvignon Blanc and put Albarino in, and is anybody else growing Albarino in the UK that you know of?
Not to our knowledge, no.
Yeah, so real pioneering sort of stuff.
Sort of, yeah, yeah.
Ripping out an award-winning grape variety wine for high-risk strategy.
It is high-risk, but of course we planted all that Chardonnay in 2007, and that's now on stream. So even though Sauvignon does make good sparkling wine, It's not in the same class as Chardonnay. So,
so you're, for your sparkling wines, you're looking to move more into the Pinot Chardonnay type of styles?
Well, we have moved. So from 09 onwards, it's all Chardonnay, Pinot, in whatever blend we've made.
I tried one of your sparkling wines, your 09 sparkling wine. I thought that was Seval.
That was Seval, yeah. That's the last Seval sparkling we made, yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the 2009 Rosé was Chardonnay and Pinot Noir.
That's right.
And then from then on, they're all Chardonnay and Pinot Noir.
Okay.
We tend to find with Chardonnay that it needs longer lees aging. It tends to be slightly higher acidity sometimes. We don't like deacidifying. So we're talking about, if you're making a Chardonnay Blanc de Blanc, for example, you're talking about 5-6 years lees aging, whereas Seval doesn't need as long. You're talking about 2-2.5 years, perhaps.
5-6 years on the lees?
Yeah.
Wow, that is a long time.
Yeah.
That is long. That is really long. Even Knightimber, who make probably the biggest, yeastiest style of sparkling wine in the UK, they're not that long.
I don't think they are. I'm not quite sure, but maybe 3 years, yeah. I'm not sure.
Oh, 5 years. We're going to... Dave, the viticulturist, and your son is holding up the hand for 5 years. You worked at Knightimber, didn't you, Dave?
Yes. Yeah. All mainly vineyard, Dave. I did one vintage in the winery. I worked in the vineyards for about 3 years.
So are you going to go for a real yeasty style with your sparkling wine?
Well, it's more about balancing the acidity and the length of time that it takes for the Chardonnay fruit to really come to the fore. So we'll taste the wines from 3 years on the lees for, you know, sort of every 6 months until we're happy with it.
Yeah.
But I'd imagine 5 years is about right.
Perfect. Dave just sort of jumped in there. He wasn't supposed to be part of the interview.
Just come in for my lunch.
Excellent. Okay, then. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much, guys.
Absolute pleasure.